you mentioned the insurer as a protector, and that's where it really comes in. I mean, we have now powerful AI models for wildfires, for flood, for tropical cyclones, all coming out of the same family of generative AI models. So it is of high relevance. And I think once we see the economic benefit and the relevance to our lives and to the insurance business, it's just too powerful to ignore.
So welcome to our next episode in our podcast, Love Tech and the Future of Insurance. Today, the topic is how AI is transforming the role of the insurer of the future from insurer to protector. How to redefine the triangle of trust, security, and people in order to remain relevant in a digital, real-time, risk-saturated world. My guest today is Frank Schmidt, a thought leader at the intersection of economics, finance, and machine learning, with a rare breadth of experience spanning the Federal Reserve, the insurance industry, and academia. Frank brings a distinctive perspective to how data-driven intelligence reshapes strategy, risk, and value creation. Known for his analytical depth and creative execution, he has long been a trusted advisor to senior executives navigating complex transformation. As we explore the insurer's evolution into the true protector in this episode, Frank's insights promise to challenge conversations and illuminate the path forward. He also functions as the CTO of General Reinsurance. Frank, you know that our podcast is called Love, Tech and the Future of Insurance. I personally fell in love with this industry 25 years ago when I did my first project with a large reinsurer based in the south of Germany. Did you fall in love with this industry? And if so, was it on first sight?
Yeah, thank you, Eduardo. It's great to be with you today. It's an absolute pleasure. Yeah, well, I fell in love with insurance when I was at the Fed, and I had previously actually taught financial services at the University of Vienna in my academic days. So I had a little bit of background. And while I was at the Fed, I had a distinct interest in labor economics still at the time.
Yeah.
And so I actually fell in love with workers' compensation. So I felt this is an important area. And that got me into insurance. Now it's broader now, but my entry point was workers' compensation, and in fact. Now, of course, as you say, the tech space is quite exciting. Right. So now we have, I started discovering technology, and looking back at my life, frankly, I wish I had, like you, started in the technology space earlier. But it took a bit of time for me to realize the power of technology and how it drives our lives.
So for me, the conversations that we have on a general basis are always inspiring, predominantly because of your visionary view and also how you connect the world of academia with the world that we live in and how to make those things work. So what brought you into technology transformation and AI based on all the other steps that you did before?
Well, it was haphazardous, and to a degree, I spent many years at AIG and did a fair amount of transformation. And then there was this opportunity at Gen Re of transforming the IT department. While never having worked in tech before, I felt this is a unique challenge. So that really inspired me, and over time, I felt more and more like a techie rather than, you know, a traditional insurance person, frankly. And this was a unique opportunity, transforming an IT department into really a modern technology space. And that's why I call myself Chief Technology Officer and not Chief Information Officer, because I really try to model it after large technology companies of, you know, in Silicon Valley. And for me, as a quantitative economist, of course, I got lucky because I've always been interested in econometrics and in machine learning. And suddenly generative AI arrived on the scene, right, in November 2022 with the release of ChatGPT. Now, that was a stroke of luck. And I brought together my old world of econometrics and machine learning and my new world of technology. So I'm particularly grateful for that.
Yeah. So you're joining us today from London, where you are preparing for your next marathon. Do you have a target time in mind? Did you set a specific target? You're very fit.
Yeah, Eduardo, as we get older, I think we start staying away from the times. But the target is to qualify for Boston. And I've done it earlier this year, so I'm quite relaxed about it. But to do it again on Sunday in this wonderful city, that would be great.
Yeah, excellent. So all the best for that run. So let's frame a little bit the stage in terms of understanding where AI is, right? So you already spoke about the stroke of luck when it all started. But before we really emerge into the depth and the connection to the insurance world, let's look at AI from a more general view and see where do we stand now in 2025. And you have witnessed a large number of domain-specific events. So I'm happy to see what you can add to the highlights that I've summarized out of a report that is called the Artificial Intelligence Index Report 25 from Stanford University. It says AI is performing and it's improving. It's improving faster than ever imagined. So the training compute doubles every 5 months, data sets every 8 months, and the power usage on an annual basis. AI is already embedded. So for those that believe that this is something for the future, it is already embedded in everyday life. And in order to prove it, let's pick two things that are highlighted in the report. FDA approved in 2023, 223 AI-enabled medical devices, up from 6 in 2015. And Waymo, for those that are not familiar with it, it's a self-driving vehicle firm. Their parent is Google, executes 150,000 autonomous drives every week. That's, of course, fantastic. AI is a magnet for investments and also regulation. So U.S. private investments have grown by $109 billion last year, and regulatory arms are all around AI in order to ensure that it functions and is trustful. And the responsible AI ecosystems are evolving. Frank, you yourself, you highlighted in your publications for Gen Re that last year, for example, was already amazing. Two Nobel Prizes, one to John Hopfield and Jeffrey Winton, recognized for their studies in deep learning, and one that is shared with additional winners for David Baker, who was recognized for computational protein design. So AI is, in my view, like the Taylor Swift of technology right now, and it's peaking in both application and public debate. So do you see it the same way, or do you think that we still have to wait for the big AI wave?
Yeah, Eduardo. Well, I think my comparison is typically to electricity, so rather than Taylor Swift. You made an important point, right? AI is already everywhere, so it is pervasive. And this is one of the three characteristics of a general purpose technology. Another one is the ability to keep improving. Mm-hmm. The technology keeps improving, has that ability for a long time, right? Same, by the way, applied to electricity. And also to spawn a co-invention process in the application sector. You mentioned medical devices, you mentioned self-driving cars, robot taxis, right? So this is the application sector, and you see a lot of co-invention happening. So these are the three characteristics of a general purpose technology, and the best comparison really is electricity. Now, what we learned from electricity is that, you know, the adoption process took many decades. And the United States was, you know, the leading country, the leading economy in the adoption of technology and the continued invention at the technology level, but also then the co-invention process and the applications like the electrification of households, etc. Mm-hmm. So it is a process that will keep playing out over a long period of time. And it's probably going to be it's fair to say already, right? It's happening faster than the adoption of electricity. And it's a fair question. It may even be accelerating. Because the challenge with AI is, you could argue it's the most general of general purpose technologies because it goes after intelligence, right?
Yeah.
If you think of, let us say, two AI systems that train each other, that learn from each other, you see the potential of acceleration, in fact. And we focus a lot on the consumer space and ChatGPT, and we can do poems and all these things and images. But you pointed out to areas where there is real progress that is highly economically beneficial, that is actually absolutely transformative. Mm-hmm. You mentioned protein folding, for instance. This is an enormous scientific breakthrough. They solved a 50-year-old problem. Right,
yeah.
And some called it the Fermat's last theorem of biology.
Yeah, we're seeing that it's happening. And yet, if we look into the industry that we both love, the insurance industry, it's all about trust, right? Trust means, in a very traditional way of an insurance firm, honor your policy. We'll pay something if bad things happen. And now, if we really transform the insurer to a protector, it changes, right? So now it means helping you to avoid harm at the first place and be there if it still occurs. So if trust is something that needs to be earned, and we all know how human it is to trust, right? Frank, how can we learn to trust AI with decisions that AI makes that affect people?
Yeah, Eduardo, I think that's an absolute critical point for the adoption, that we as insurance executives learn to trust the technology.
Mm-hmm.
It's not easy because when you think, let's talk about alpha fold and protein folding, right? When Google DeepMind developed that AI system that solved this biological problem, that AI system does not understand chemistry, has no understanding of the underlying science. It makes predictions just based on connections that it makes. We lose this ability to interpret things in a causal way. So the insurance industry for decades developed predictive modeling, and it's an important tool for decision making. And we have regression coefficients that we can interpret in a causal way. It may not always be causal, but they deliver an important narrative for decision making, and they are incredibly valuable in their predictive power. But now something better comes along, better in terms of making more powerful predictions, much more powerful predictions. First, traditional machine learning, and now deep learning, which is the engine behind generative AI. And now we have input and output, and it's hard for us to figure out, in fact, what is happening in between, right? And you mentioned cars, right?
Yes.
And with cars, when we learned how to drive a car, we developed what is called an abstraction layer. So we don't really understand the physics of the car. Frankly, I don't. And even if you now understand some of the engineering at the quantum mechanical level, you really don't understand the physics. And yet, we all drive cars, and we learned to trust these tools because we learned that as we step on the throttle, the car accelerates and turn the steering wheel to the right, the car veers to the right. So we build an abstraction layer. And if we drive an unfamiliar car and that behaves slightly differently, we adjust that abstraction layer, that abstraction. Now, machine learning or deep learning, generative AI, is we should evaluate in the same way. We should evaluate based on its predictive benefit.
Yeah.
But we lose that causal interpretation to a high degree, sometimes completely. And causality is so important for the forming of narratives, to package things up in a coherent way and communicate it to other and then make a decision.
Yeah.
So there is a fair amount of work to do for us in the insurance industry to really put AI to productive use in decision-making.
If explainability is a realistic requirement for AI in insurance, do you think it's possible, or should we just really more focus on accountability and outcome transparency? Because based on this, it's like happening subconsciously. And then, you know, it's like if I try to reflect what you said, it would be an example. Try to remember what you dreamt last night, right? So I know it had an effect on me. I was angry or afraid, but I don't even can put the things together because it happened subconsciously and I cannot basically access that information. But I can tell you for sure it has happened that way. So if I can't explain it, and I think that's a key takeaway, right? So from what you're saying, should we focus more than on accountability and transparency of the outcome? And how do we ensure to get there? Because in all the tests that we've done with AI, this is a major, major challenge.
Yeah, in the world of that, focusing on the outcome, exactly, evaluating it based on the predictive benefit.
Yeah.
And that accountability, that is critical. At the same time, we should not give up on trying to understand how AI systems really work, deep learning systems work. But for us in the insurance industry as decision makers, it really must be outcome-based. That's the only chance we have. So we lose some of that interpretation that is correct.
We're losing that, and we need to perform it on an even larger scale, because what we're currently doing in the industry is very, to a certain extent, siloed. There's a lack of integration in those activities, and everybody's talking about scale. So how can trust scale digitally? Do you have a perspective on that?
Well, maybe it's best to start with an example. Weather forecasting. Yeah, weather forecasting is one of the areas you mentioned, other areas, but one of the areas where generative AI has made enormous progress and contributions is weather forecasting. And again, Google DeepMind, right? They published a GraphCast a couple of years ago, and then also GenCast. Now, there are two types of weather forecasting. One is deterministic, and one are so-called ensemble models that give you a cone of uncertainty. These are usually different types of models. And these ensemble models typically start with different starting points in the simulations that give you different paths, and that they create that cone. Now, some of the most powerful computers in the world are actually dedicated to weather forecasting, right? So these are physical, traditional weather forecasting models are physics-based models. So they are partial differential equations solved by supercomputers that work away on it for 1 or 2 hours, well over 100,000 lines of code. Now, these are physics-based models, so there is causality, but you and I trust the weather forecast, even though we don't understand the models, right?
Yeah.
So I think weather forecasting is an entry point for us to learn to trust generative AI, because here comes Google DeepMind's GraphCast and GenCast. So GraphCast being the most accurate weather forecasting model in the world, deterministic weather forecasting model, and a version of it was just adopted by the European Center for Medium Range Weather Forecasting. So this model beats the most accurate physics-based model in the world, and it does not know anything about physics. The model does not understand physics, similar to AlphaFold not understanding chemistry, yet it produces these accurate forecasts, and it's particularly good at predicting extreme weather events, which matters for insurance. So now, both times, we have a model that you and I don't really fully grasp, right? You and I are not that deep into physics to understand a physics-based weather forecasting model. And so maybe it doesn't matter that much that we understand how these models work for the consumer, right?
Yeah.
Is this an entry point for us to learn, generative AI, this generative AI model is not based on the laws of physics. It does not know about the laws of physics, and yet it delivers this forecast. Isn't that somewhat equivalent to a physics-based model, which we also do not understand? So I've been thinking about this being a potential entry point to develop a relationship of trust with a generative AI system.
Yeah, the predictions that they're producing are tremendously accurate, and they've been mentioned. I visited InsurTech in London just a few weeks ago, and that was a very powerful theme that was echoed by a lot of the executives in their presentations as well. So maybe that's the angle that we need to take, because it's also so connected to our everyday. Of course, we need it in the insurance world for the prediction of catastrophes, but it's also something which is very close to our own desire. And everyone that has lived in an area where weather is impacting your life will definitely buy into that and build the necessary trust if it sees that it delivers the results.
Exactly. Exactly. And it's highly relevant for insurance.
Yeah.
Right. And, you know, then you mentioned the insurer as a protector.
Yeah.
And that's where it really comes in. I mean, we have now powerful AI models for wildfires, for flood, for tropical cyclones.
Yeah.
All coming out of the same family of generative AI models. So it is of high relevance. And I think once we see the economic benefit and the relevance to our lives and to the insurance business, it's just too powerful to ignore.
Agreed. Okay, so maybe we have found a path into the trust. And now that the trust is developing, and we all know this from personal relationships, we need a certain level of security to protect it. I would say that security is the bodyguard of this trust, and it makes this trust also resilient. Leading voices like Sandra Joyce pointed out that AI reduces the delta between the threat actor and the defense, meaning it makes the threat actor more powerful, but also the defense more powerful as well. You need to deal with this on a daily basis also in your decision making. So what is your take on security to protect that trust that we are starting to build with AI?
Yeah, that is a big topic, Eduardo. Clearly, one can look at it from various angles. You mentioned Sandra Joyce, head of threat intelligence at Google. Also, Jen Easterly made a similar statement just recently. She was the former head of CISA. And yeah, I mean, let's focus on this for a moment. AI benefits greatly from data, and leading platforms in the space of cybersecurity that have many clients, they can learn from the data of a lot of clients as the data go up into the cloud in an anonymized way, and then algorithms learning from the data and then feeding information back to the clients. And whereas a threat actor has only its own data,
yeah,
that is the angle, like some sort of federated learning across a lot of clients. And there are various architectures and various ways of going about this. But deep learning clearly does make the defenses quite powerful in terms of threat detection. Of course, there are other angles, right? I mean, open source AI models themselves do pose a threat way beyond cybersecurity. It's also a question of national security, maybe a different topic, but and then there is the aspect of deepfakes, right? So, they, of course, they are getting powerful. And so phishing attacks are more dangerous. And we have to develop intellectual armor here so that we don't fall for these fakes. So maybe as human beings, we have to develop intellectual armor. And that will happen. When the internet came along, we learned to trust the internet. It took us a while. But remember, there was the internet and there was information. How can you trust this?
Yeah.
But we learned, we developed intellectual armor. We were able to leverage the internet to learn and to retrieve information that we can trust. So we have to develop intellectual armor against deepfakes and other nefarious actions on the part of threat actors. So we discover them as human. So that's the human element. Before that, I mentioned the deep learning element, the access to massive amounts of data across many clients. And not only are many clients, you can also leverage data across your security tools, endpoint protection, firewall, etc., right?
Yeah.
So that also is an opportunity. So there are reasons to believe that generative AI is greatly increasing the power of the defense.
And if I hear what you're saying, and for me, one question which arises is from an executive perspective, is it not necessary, and I don't know if you would agree, so happy to have a debate on it, this entire protection around security, AI-driven and data for me requires a mindset of being in an infinite game. So something that cannot be won, something that needs to basically evolve into the next level. There's no end to it. I compare it potentially a little bit with the Cold War, where it was always kind of the necessity to maintain that equilibrium to a certain extent. Is it necessary to really operate with that mindset of infinite kind of game? Have we not lost already in the moment that we think it's finite, that you would basically just buy something and evolve something or create a protection and then you're done?
Well, that's a tough question, Eduardo, because it's about the future. But let me just give you an example. You mentioned the Cold War. There was a time when, you know, the Soviet Union started developing nuclear weapons and building missiles that could reach the United States. There was a time when the thinking was to match the number of warheads and carrier systems that would be the best response of the United States. And then in the early 60s, around the Cuban Missile Crisis, the thinking started changing. And Thomas Schelling, for instance, an economist and games theoretician, was a major thought leader in that space to say, well, maybe not. Maybe we do not have to match the warheads and carrier systems. Maybe it's good enough to be able to strike back after having been struck. Yeah. Because if we are able to do that, then there won't be a first strike of the adversary in the first place. Mm-hmm. So you see that at the level of national security and, you know, the nuclear posture I'm talking about here changed in important ways, and it was a process that took years. And maybe something similar is happening in the cyberspace. And I give you an example. The ability to recover from backups should be of the highest priority, because that is, here the analogy to the Cold War kicks in. Because if you're able to recover from backups, that greatly reduces your vulnerability.
Yeah.
Of course, there's still the risk of data loss, right? You have seen a change in thinking in cybersecurity toward exactly that, the ability to recover from backups. And there's also the percentage of instances where ransom is actually being paid has decreased dramatically, in fact, over the years. I'm not saying the number of ransomware attacks has decreased, but the percentage of cases where ransom is actually being paid has gone down, and there's public information on that.
We have now the security established for the trust, and then we look at the greatest asset that we have in an insurance company, which is similar to my business in consulting, which is technically the people. And when we did our preparatory activities for this podcast, you said something that resonated with me. And you said, I think to be really effective using AI, the question is, at which level of qualification do you have to be? And so if I think about that question, and also related with this thing of labor replacement versus labor augmentation, I, of course, prefer the latter of both, because for us, people is the center of our ambition. And I think that there's, and I like to see the positive things on the evolutionary case. And I came across The Coming Wave by Mustafa Suleiman, right? So the co-founder of DeepMind. He offered such a strategic and provocative look at the disruptive impact of AI and synthetic biology technologies called omni-use. I was wondering, because this is, of course, one of the key questions. How do we get our organization, you in your case for Gen Re, in my view for our firm, right? So how do we really prepare them for this? And how do we find the right path for that implication? So what are your thoughts on that? And
yeah,
could be, you know, of course, excited to hear what you have to share.
Yeah, Eduardo. Well, I think we have to remind ourselves that this is an adoption process, right? A technology adoption process that will play out over a long period of time. And one thing seems to be certain, that the skills demand will change, right? The skills that are required by an organization, that will change. Now, we may also be organized in a very different way. Let's think of it this way. One of the challenges, one of the limitations that we have as humans, that it's not easy for us to coordinate. We do, right? We have meetings and they take a long time and we coordinate via emails, etc. But AI agents can coordinate the actions, thoughts and actions in seconds or milliseconds. And human beings spend so much time coordinating. And that's a frictional cost to the organization. And the reason organizations are organized the way they are, that's related to that frictional cost, right? To the cost of coordinating. So we may also see, aside from the change in skills demand, also a change in the way we are organized, looking into the future. Mm. Now, clearly, we have had 250 years of automation. Mm-hmm. And so automation has two effects on labor, as you mentioned, substitution of labor, but also augmentation. And augmentation clearly has been the dominating force. Otherwise, we wouldn't be paid as much as we are. So after 250 years of automation, everybody still has a job. And these jobs pay quite well. So
yes,
if it were a substitution of labor, we would live in poverty.
Yeah.
So that's the past 250 years. And last year, I was quite optimistic. We had all these co-pilots, and as they do to increase productivity, they gave us an idea of what they can do someday. And definitely in coding, we are heavily using co-pilots in coding. All my coders do. And we see the productivity benefits, no doubt. But now we are so clearly augmentation of labor, no question. Now, this year, you're moving in our thinking from the co-pilot to the AI agent. And you're thinking about it, and we're looking into opportunities. But what's now clearly, you wonder, what's augmentation and what is substitution? How many employees does a given organization really need once you have AI agents? So now the specter of organizations operating with a lot less staff is actually becoming real. And again, it's an adoption process. It will take time, but it made me think a lot about the future. And now, again, the past 250 years, we have not, substitution of labor was not the driving force. But AI goes after intelligence, right? And that's the most general of purpose technologies. So maybe this time is different. I cannot say.
It's definitely something that we need to prepare in two ways, right? So one, what is the outcome of this transformation process that is difficult to foresee, but it's clearly heading into certain directions. And the other is, of course, how to enable those that are there to really be able to use that enhancement, use that augmentation in more fascinating ways than we see them today. And so I think there's also some excitement in that, in going into this fight and trying to do it. We have taken an approach of trying to be playful with the staff so that they all can try, because it's nothing where you can sit down and really, I mean, you can, of course, read and operate, but I think it requires more than just the usage of AI. It requires to understand how it functions. And you already highlighted it very nicely around the first question around trust, and how the model really works is really relevant. And people need to understand that in order to be able to harness the power that is embedded in that, and the best way possible.
Yeah. On that note, I mean, we are on a journey from task level improvement. So given employees performing given task and doing that better with co-pilots, to the next level, which is workflow redesign. Greater co-invention effort, because now you have to think about how should workflows really be organized? Should certain tasks even be done? And who should do it? And when should it be done in the workflow? So workflow redesign, greater co-invention effort, but also greater benefit. And then on to what I mentioned, organizational redesign, even greater co-invention effort, but even greater economic benefits. And of course, we have to think about this on a timeline. These things do take time to play out.
I've thought about where I will be in 5 years, and maybe the answer to that means growing lemons, because that cannot be potentially substituted in the same way that I can grow lemons. Frank, what are you doing in 5 years from now when AI has taken over all the intelligence? Do you have a thought on that?
Well, I hope I'll still be running marathons, first of all, but the lemon growing is a good point. Like when Jeffrey Hinton, whose team developed deep learning in 2012 with AlexNet, when he was asked by students, you know, what he recommends them to do, he said to become a plumber, because as you pointed out, certain manual tasks are actually not that easy to do by AI. And a couple of days ago, there was the marathon in Beijing, and alongside there was also a half marathon. And in the half marathon, several robots actually did compete. Not many finished. And it was funny, actually, one of them, after a couple of steps, actually sat down and refused to go on. So it's still some work to do when it comes to manual tasks. Yeah, so plumber is or growing lemons is probably still safe. Again, right? I mean, in the past, what happened is because technological progress increased productivity, and that way also increased, of course, income. And income increases spending. And we are spending income today on things that our parents did not spend income on. And so there's new demand springs up, and with new demand, jobs are being created. There are no pilots without airplanes, and there is no computer programmer without a computer. So in the past, technology itself created new jobs, but also then the rising incomes by creating new consumer demand also created new jobs. So that's what some economists think will play out over time. You pointed out, Eduardo, that the pace is rather rapid and maybe even accelerating. When you think about AI systems learning from one another, there's also the potential for an acceleration, in fact, of AI adoption.
Yeah. The World Economic Forum has published a study on future of jobs, or it's a survey, I believe, and the one that I'm citing here is from 2024. Core skills in 2030 was kind of the question. And one of them, and this is potentially the humoristic part of everything that we're discussing here, is that if you look into the core skills, the majority of the skills that are embedded there are very, very human. And one of them is resilience, flexibility, and agility. And I would think that you would need that for your marathon. I think it's on Saturday, right? So Sunday?
Sunday,
yeah. So you would need a lot of that. And I remember my discussion with a triathlete, a professional triathlete. And I always said to him, "Oh, I don't know how you can do it. It's all about suffering." And then he said to me, "Well, that's what humans can do much better than any other animal on this planet, to suffer and to stick to the target." Maybe that's something that we need to remind ourselves, that suffering is part of that transformation. But then if we are resilient and strong, we will get over that hurdle together as well.
Yeah, and that's a good point, Eduardo. It's a deep human experience for sure.
Yeah. All right. So I think we've covered all the topics and it's been a great discussion. If there's one thing that insurers must do right now with regards to AI in order to become a protector, what would be your advice?
On the technological side, I think AI adoption requires a modern data architecture, which requires insurers to be in the cloud. So there's a lexicographic order to that.
Yeah.
Cloud enables a modern data architecture, which enables AI. So anybody who is not in the cloud or doesn't have built the data foundations for the adoption of generative AI should review that position. I think that's on the technology side very important. Another important aspect is to make AI available, as you say, Eduardo, in a playful way to associates so they can familiarize themselves with it. And thirdly, keep an eye open for the technological change. We talked about weather forecasting by Google, wildfires, flood risk, etc. These models are powerful. And there will be further improvements. I think it's important to put oneself in a position of optionality so that as the technology improves, one automatically benefits from the advances. And much of it happens at the level of the hyperscaler or the cloud service provider, be it AWS, Google Cloud, or Azure. So for us, generative AI is largely a matter of orchestrating the native capabilities of the cloud service provider, and that way automatically benefit from the progress that the technology makes. And, you know, back to protector, right? I mean, it's every large organization has a service desk, and the ideal, you want to use generative AI to make sure that a call to the service desk doesn't happen in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
That's how technology should be used, rather than service desk associate using AI. That's also fine. That's augmentation. The same way you can use AI in weather forecasting, flood modeling, etc., right?
Mm-hmm.
So that the damage doesn't happen in the first case. You can use generative AI for damage assessment, claims processing, yes, but you can also use it in a way so a claim doesn't happen in the first place and people are able to prepare themselves better for such calamities.
Yeah. Frank, I would like to thank you so much for joining our episode. It's been, as always, a true pleasure and has given us a lot of things to think about. Good luck with the marathon on Sunday.
Thank you, Eduardo. It was an absolute pleasure to be on your podcast.
At the start of today's episode, I asked Frank how AI is transforming the insurer of the future from payer of claims to a true protector, and how the triangle of trust, security, and people must be redefined to stay relevant in a digital, real-time, risk-saturated world. Our conversation showed AI enables insurers not just to respond faster to incidents, but to prevent them before they cause harm, turning protection into a proactive promise rather than a reactive service. I took away three key ideas that stood out clearly to me. Trust in AI grows when repeated experiences with reliable outcomes build lasting confidence. Protecting customers means staying ahead of risk using AI to forecast challenges and take early action to minimize harm. And of course, none of this works without people. To really make AI part of our future, we need strong cloud-based foundations, the right skills, and a culture that embraces change and innovation. After we stopped recording, Frank and I continued exchanging ideas. And he shared yet another very compelling example from his own work at GenRe. He described how AI is being applied in their IT help desk operations, outlining three key approaches. First, substitution of labor with AI chatbots, an option they decided against due to service quality concerns. Second, augmenting human work by supporting employees with AI-driven forensics and guidance, which is the preferred current model. And third, the most transformative approach, preventing incidents before they happen through intelligent monitoring and proactive intervention. I hope today's episode sparked some ideas for you as well. If you enjoyed it, please follow us, share it with your friends and colleagues, and leave us a review wherever you listen to podcasts. I'm Eduardo Dalma, and thanks for listening to Love, Tech, and the Future of Insurance.